I'm Bonnie Lin, Director of the China Power Project and Senior Fellow for Asian Security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This episode of the China Power Podcast will feature one of five debates we held about China during our 2023 conference this fall. Each debate involves two leading experts taking a different position on one aspect of Chinese power. Happy holidays and thanks for tuning in. We'll be back with new guests in January 2024.
For our last panel, we are focused on the proposition that China's accelerated expansion of its nuclear arsenal represents a shift in China's nuclear strategy and doctrine. I'm not going to go through how China has expanded its nuclear capability because Eli covered a little bit of that earlier today. So let me turn to the poll. And while the poll is up, I will also introduce our two experts. Again, the poll is the same as our prior polls. You can take it by looking at the QR code, by scanning the QR code, or via the online link. And while the poll is loading, let me introduce our two speakers. I think anyone working on nuclear issues or China nuclear issues in the U.S. are very familiar with these two speakers. To my left, arguing for this proposition, is Dr. Tong Zhao, a senior fellow at the Nuclear Policy Program and Carnegie China at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is also a non-resident researcher at the Science and Global Security Program of Princeton University and associate editor of the journal Science and Global Security. He conducts research on strategic security issues, such as nuclear weapons policy deterrence and China's security and foreign policy. And I think we're very delighted that now Tong is mainly based in the United States, particularly in DC, whereas before I think we had to fly him out from China all the time to attend our conferences. Arguing against the proposition is Dr. Fiona Cunningham. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She has held fellowships at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Stanford University, Harvard University, Renmin University of China. And her research focuses on how countries have leveraged nuclear, space, cyber, and missile technology for coercion, particularly with respect to China. And we're very delighted that she actually just took the Amtrak and arrived about 15 minutes ago. So we're glad that we were able to make this last debate work. So let me turn to the polls. The current polls that we're having from our in-person audience as well as the our online audience, and it shows that about 67% agree that China's accelerated nuclear arsenal represents a shift in its nuclear policy, and about 33% disagree. Now, let me also show you the poll that we conducted on Twitter a couple days ago and what those Twitter polls show in terms of this, approximately the same with more agreeing online than disagreeing. So I think, Tong, you actually have an easier job to argue than Fiona. But let me turn to you to argue for why you might see a change in China's nuclear strategy.
Thank you for having me. I'm not going to argue that everything about China's nuclear thinking and nuclear strategy has changed. And I think I'm not going to fundamentally disagree with Fiona. I actually have an upcoming Carnegie report on China's evolving nuclear thinking, and I think I will be able to better explain nuanced thoughts on this topic there. But for the sake of argument today, let me highlight a number of important changes I think has happened about China's nuclear strategy, especially those that are paid less attention about here in DC. So for me, there are two main, of course, there are many ways to define strategy, but for me, there are two main elements. One is the goals, and then the second, the means to achieve the goals. I think there are both important changes in the two aspects. First, the goals of China's nuclear weapons. I think previously it's safe to say that the main goal of China's nuclear strategy is to maintain a credible second strike capability to deter a major nuclear attack. In other words, to maintain basic nuclear stability relationship with its nuclear rivals. But now I think in addition to that traditional goal, there is increasing change in the sense that now nuclear weapons are also more and more used as a tool to influence international perception about the balance of strategic power. And in that sense, it can help counter the increasing geopolitical threats that China thinks it itself is under. But in any case, nuclear weapons are for addressing existential threats. And here, I think in China, existential threat perception has significantly increased in recent decade. Mr. Xi came to power with a greater determination to preventively address the rising existential threats facing China. You know, he had this stronger antipathy towards Western ideologies. This, you know, goes back to our previous session discussion about the ideological confrontation. You know, he was very aware of Soviet Union's collapse. He, you know, was determined to avoid that for China. He, you know, wanted to address the increasing structural change within China. And as he tries to promote the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation, he kind of anticipated that there is going to be growing Western pushback, especially if China wants to make progress on issues of national unification. He anticipated, you know, the increasing possibility of struggles with Western, US-led Western countries. And as a result, he actually saw greater threats from the US-led Western countries as he expected when, you know, Western and international community saw China taken, you know, more repressive approach to, you know, strengthen internal unity and to promote China's international interests. There is stronger criticisms against China's policy in Xinjiang, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in domestic, you know, repression. All of that appeared to Xi as a direct attack against China's regime security. And that's more important. Regime security is more important than everything else. And that's clearly said in Chinese official documents. So that creates even greater level of existential threat perception in China's top leadership's mind than they actually expected. And here, I think Xi appears to believe that if China can demonstrate stronger strategic military capability, including nuclear weapons, it could somehow make the US-led Western countries behave more carefully and dial down their perceived geopolitical attack against the Chinese regime, against Chinese core interests. And this, you know, lines up very well with Xi's increasing order to the military to expedite and then accelerate China's nuclear modernization process. There's clear sense of urgency, which is new than before, for China to expand its nuclear power. I would argue that the Chinese choice of constructing large silo-based ICBM sites, three of them simultaneously, reflects this sense of urgency. There is an underlying logic behind the belief that demonstrating stronger nuclear and strategic military power could help counter the perceived geopolitical threats. The thinking is, if the U.S. knows that in a nuclear confrontation, there's no way that U.S. will be able to win, that will make the U.S. more careful in fighting a conventional war with China, because U.S. would need to worry about the potential escalation of conventional war to the nuclear level. And if the U.S., you know, is more worried about fighting a conventional war with China, then the U.S. perhaps will be more careful, you know, to avoid any conflict from taking place. So if China can, you know, demonstrate stronger nuclear power, blocking the road of escalation and denying U.S. escalation dominance, that would eventually make the U.S. try to avoid any serious conflict with China. So in that sense, China is attaching greater political value to nuclear weapons. From the outside, it looks like China indeed has embraced a stronger ambition to develop a greater nuclear force. This is demonstrated by China's apparent effort to narrow the gap with the American nuclear capabilities. Chinese interest to pursue a world-class military power certainly applies to strategic nuclear capabilities as well. China's open pursuit of nuclear triad capability, which is a major change from its previous opposition against nuclear triad. The changing official narrative, the previous emphasis on building a lean and effective nuclear capability, even though that term is still maintained occasionally and used occasionally today, the greater emphasis now is to build a powerful strategic deterrent capability. That change of term, you know, is a major evidence of significant change. However, the other side of the coin is the fear and the sense of insecurity in China. The reason China feels that it needs to demonstrate stronger strategic capability is because it has greater fear. It has greater fear about its, you know, core interests. It has developed stronger existential threat perception. So fear and ambition are the two sides of the same coin, and I would argue fear is actually the more important underlying and more direct driver of China's nuclear buildup. But if we do not fully understand both fear and ambition aspects of the Chinese thinking, I think the U.S. could run the risk of adopting countermeasures that would actually feed into Chinese fear and lead to more counterproductive results. And secondly, let me talk about how the means through which China wants to achieve its security by nuclear weapons have changed. The logic that stronger nuclear power could have political benefit and could change the behavior of your rival at, you know, conventional military level and even political levels, that logic, you know, makes sense, but it's an intuitive logic. There's no empirical proof to demonstrate that effect. And also how that logic guides China's calculation of the sufficient number of nuclear weapons it actually needs to achieve that goal. Previously, the Chinese calculation of number of sufficient nuclear weapons was already based on the worst case scenario in which the US, China are in the all-out war, right? They want to destroy each other. All bets are off. That's how China China calculates how many weapons could survive a comprehensive U.S. first strike and still be sufficient to launch destructive retaliation. So even if U.S.-China geopolitical tensions grow, in theory, China shouldn't need to build a larger a nuclear force, because the current number is already based on the worst-case calculation. However, it could be argued that China may worry that because of the growing strategic hostility, the U.S. might be more willing to exploit the small vulnerability of Chinese nuclear forces. But then the question is, if that's the case, then how much more or how many more nuclear weapons could address that gap? And I think this is where the Chinese strategy is becoming increasingly incoherent. It lacks analytical rigor to connect the goal with the operational capabilities. And here, I think Fiona actually made a very interesting discovery in one of her recent publications. She found that a senior Chinese military strategist said that Xi Jinping personally guided the making and drafting of China's strategic nuclear policy. And here I do think the personal view of Xi is very important. He showed greater sympathy to that logic that greater nuclear weapons can contribute to greater political stability. And this is different from previous leaders. Previous leaders tried to restrain the military. Because the military, that they always wanted to expand nuclear capabilities. But Xi appeared to have encouraged the military to do that. And Xi's personal authority within the Chinese system has been much more stronger than before. And under this system of one-person rule, when Xi gives the personal mandate, gave his personal blessing to massively expand Chinese nuclear power, the military, the defense industry, they tend to overdo it in order to please the top leadership. And here, the increasing lack of checks and balances in China's increasingly centralized and authoritarian system does make a big difference because, firstly, the experts, they no longer can play that role of checks and balances. In fact, many Chinese civilian military experts, they appear to be cut off from the nuclear expansion decision-making. They didn't know that China was building the large silo sites. And before this massive expansion, many Chinese nuclear experts still were arguing that China didn't need a major increase of nuclear capability. That China just needed to keep modest and incremental nuclear modernization. And the general public, has a stronger nationalistic sentiment. There is no media, independent media, that could even let the public, keep the public informed, or even the experts informed, what is going on with China's nuclear program. And on the other hand, you have more military services and branches because China is now pursuing nuclear triad capabilities, not just only the Rocket Force, also the Navy, the Air Force, who all have an incentive to, try to argue for a bigger nuclear cake. So when you have stronger and, more diverse stakeholders, and on the other hand, you have no one trying to push back, of course, it's so easy to overdo it. So what I'm trying to argue here is that a major change in the means with China, through which China tries to achieve its goal is not that China has adopted a fundamentally different approach of nuclear thinking or nuclear policy, but the increasing lack of a clearly defined approach to achieve China's security goal. From a traditionally more science-based technical calculation to a less science-based and less expert-informed nuclear policy, a more political-driven process of decision-making. And that makes Chinese nuclear policy increasingly less predictable. And there are many examples of this increasing incoherency. I don't think I have time to go through them. You can see many or more internal tensions and contradictions in Chinese thinking. On the one hand, China wants a bigger nuclear arsenal, but China still appears to want to stick to its traditional thinking of asymmetric deterrence. China thinks that its nuclear buildup can make things better at the political level for itself, but has not considered how other countries might react and respond, and how its own nuclear buildup might affect its own long-term goal of having a more security, and how to evaluate the success when the goal is to achieve political stability. All of those things are not well thought out. And when you talk about the military is increasingly using terms like achieving strategic victory as a goal for China's nuclear weapons. That's very new. China always wanted to avoid talking about nuclear war fighting, winning nuclear war, but now winning strategic victory is a key goal of Chinese nuclear weapons, does that mean Chinese military is now trying to fight nuclear wars and win nuclear wars? I don't think so, because it doesn't, it's not consistent with everything else the Chinese military strategists are writing about. A more likely explanation is that the military, especially in the Rocky Force, are trying to please, they're trying to cater to Mr. Xi's political instruction for the military to be more prepared for combat in general, right? That's a general instruction from Xi for many years. So the, maybe the Rocky Force, they also wanted to demonstrate that they are implementing faithfully the top leadership's instruction. Therefore, they included some terms into their new language, but they haven't really figured out what that really means operationally for Chinese nuclear policy. My last point, which is another perhaps more concrete example of the change in the means through which China maintains its credible nuclear deterrence, which is China appears to be paying greater attention to escalation management. The traditional Chinese view on nuclear escalation is that, which Fiona also wrote an excellent paper in International Security, the traditional Chinese view is conventional war is very unlikely to escalate to the nuclear level because countries know the consequences. However, once the nuclear threshold is crossed, there's no way, it's very hard to manage it. It will quickly escalate all the way into an all-out nuclear exchange. However, that traditional view, I think, is being reconsidered in China. This is partly driven by China's perceived change in American nuclear thinking. They think, as American conventional military superiority declines, especially in the Asia-Pacific theater, the U.S. would have greater incentive to threaten nuclear first use in a conventional war, such as over Taiwan. And the recent U.S. Policies of re-emphasizing low-yield tactical nuclear weapons, forward deployment of these nuclear weapon systems to the region further reinforced those Chinese concerns. That's one reason. Another reason perhaps is the increasing availability of resources and also the changing Chinese self-image. China has long understood there's a major vulnerability in its traditional nuclear policy, which is China could only deter a large-scale nuclear attack, but it lacked the capability to deter limited nuclear use because that it didn't have theater-range precision nuclear weapons to do that. But China, you know, China recognized that vulnerability as early as the 1980s, but China didn't really act upon it until in recent years. I think that's it's at least partly a result of increasing available resources, including technical capability to build precision nuclear forces and increasing economic resources. And in other words, China is more seriously pursuing escalation management capability. And similarly, there is increasing evidence that China is shifting or is increasingly interested in shifting from a recessed nuclear posture of, you know, maintaining nuclear weapons on low alert levels during peacetime, or even separating the warheads from missiles and storing them at different locations, towards launch under attack or launch on warning capability. I would argue that those two changes have the greatest potential to destabilize future U.S.-China nuclear relationship. Let me stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Many questions that I have for you, but I'll wait until Fiona has presented her arguments.
Okay. So can everybody hear me okay? Or do I need to switch this? Okay, terrific. Yes, that sounds more like the microphone is on. All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for sticking around until the very last speaker of a long day of what sounds like some really energetic debates. I'll try and add some energy into this. Although I do have to acknowledge at the start that, like Tong, I don't think we're vehemently in opposition in our interpretation of this debate topic, but for the sake of debate, what I'm going to do is really focus on the military effects of China's nuclear buildup, which I think at its core is what matters to the political leverage points that Tong brought up, as well as to draw out some, I think, different implications of the points that he made, especially about the changes in decision-making within China. So I'm going to make three key points that are in opposition to our debate proposition. The first is that I think there's too little evidence at this stage to conclude that China has changed its nuclear strategy and doctrine. I think most of the evidence that's currently available can support both continuity and change in the goals of China's nuclear strategy. The second point I'm going to make is that I think there is reasonable evidence, as Tong, I think, has already laid out very effectively, that China's decision-making process for nuclear strategy and doctrine has changed, but that change does not necessarily mean that it has new goals for its nuclear strategy. And finally, what I'm going to end with is that given that treating China as if its nuclear strategy has changed, risks a self-fulfilling prophecy of encouraging or inciting those changes, I think that the evidentiary bar for acting on this conclusion should be quite high for the United States and its allies. So in other words, we need to be pretty confident that China is changing its nuclear strategy before we start making policies on that basis. So I'll spend most of my time on my first point and a little bit less on the others. So let's dive in. So on my first point, that changes to China's nuclear capabilities and operations are consistent with both continuity and change in the goals of China's nuclear arsenal. I think to argue this point, we first need to be clear about China's past nuclear strategy and doctrine and the role that its nuclear weapons would be playing in any given conflict. So the accelerated expansion of China's nuclear arsenal, I would argue, began around 2019. That was the year that the DIA began to publicly predict that the size of the force would double. And so it's useful, I think, to look at what China's goals for its nuclear forces were at that point. So at least sort of semi-authoritative PRC sources indicate that China's nuclear forces really had two goals. The first was to prevent an adversary from engaging in nuclear compellence to alter China's behavior in what would otherwise be a conventional conflict. So this is this idea of preventing nuclear blackmail that Mao Zedong was fairly fond of stating. And the second key goal was to retaliate if China suffered from a nuclear attack. So not to turn this into a definitional debate, but for the purposes of this debate, I'm defining a change in China's nuclear strategy and doctrine as a change in these goals rather than a change in how China goes about implementing these goals using its capabilities and operations. So I'm disagreeing a little bit with Tong in the question of how much the means matter here, because China has adjusted the implementation of its the goals of its nuclear forces in the past, and we haven't necessarily said that, well, it's changing its nuclear strategy. So I think this is a fair yardstick for the debate, is really to focus on what is the nuclear force designed to do. So I think China's nuclear strategy and doctrine would change if it adopted any of the following three goals. The first is threatening nuclear first use to try to change the outcomes of a conventional conflict. So you can think Russia or Pakistan styles. The second is that China might be changing its nuclear strategy and doctrine in service of a competitive nuclear strategy that involved either pursuit of nuclear parity with the United States or counterforce capabilities of its own that could be used to threaten the U.S. nuclear arsenal. That, I think, would be a second quite different goal. And the third, I think, important possible goal of China's nuclear forces would be using nuclear weapons as a shield to enable conventional offensive campaigns. So is there evidence to suggest that China is pursuing any of these three goals, which obviously there are others, but I think these are the three, like, militarily most important kind of possibilities. So let's start with a quick review of what has changed in China's nuclear forces in recent years. First of all, I think the size of the force is increasing. It now numbers between 350 to roughly just over 400 nuclear warheads, depending upon whether you use official or unofficial estimates. The Pentagon has estimated that China's nuclear forces are going to grow to 1,500 by 2035, assuming that it continues along the current trajectory of the growth in its arsenal, which I think is a reasonable assumption, but it's also not a certain one. Second, PLA media reports indicate that China's nuclear forces at both the theater level as well as the intercontinental level are becoming more accurate. Third, the Pentagon has reported that at least some PLA land-based missiles are now conducting peacetime patrols where they are armed with nuclear warheads, and that this experimentation began in around 2016, shifting some portion of the force onto a higher alert status. And this is the kind of moving away from this recessed posture that Tong mentioned. There's also speculation that China might adopt a launch on warning alert status, although I personally remain skeptical that China, or at least it's unclear, I think, from the existing evidence whether China has actually made a decision to move in this direction or not. And China also lacks the kind of optimal space and ground-based warning capabilities to provide it with the kind of early warning system for a launch on warning alert status. The fourth, I think, key change is that China is fielding a more diverse nuclear force. At the theater level, it now has an operational triad, and it has constructed new missile silos that will be filled not only with some of its more advanced solid-fueled ICBMs, but also, more surprisingly, some of its older liquid-fueled missiles, despite the fact that otherwise China has spent most of the last three decades moving to a more mobile nuclear force. It's developing novel delivery systems, so its FOBS test that some of you might remember from 2 years ago, potential for nuclear-propelled underwater systems, and the Pentagon has suggested China might also be developing low-yield capabilities. So that's the sort of piece of what we're talking about when we're talking about the accelerated expansion of the force. But I'm going to argue that I think inferring China's goals from these capabilities actually doesn't get us too far in answering the critical question of what kind of a nuclear force does China ultimately seek, and whether that arsenal that it ultimately seeks is actually going to serve any of those three new goals that I pointed to earlier in my remarks. So regarding the kind of prospect of moving towards a first use posture, as I've argued in a recent article in Arms Control Today, I think that improvements to the size, the accuracy, the readiness and diversity of China's nuclear forces make its retaliatory capability more robust, but they also enable it to make more credible threats of nuclear first use than was possible in the past. So they serve both kinds of possibilities, continuity as well as change. So let's take, for example, China's improving theater nuclear force. It added this accurate dual-use DF-26 intermediate-range ballistic missile that does enable China to make more credible threats of nuclear first use, because it enables China to inflict less collateral damage, to focus on striking military targets given the increasing accuracy of that capability should it engage in any initial nuclear strike, which could then allow it to sort of manage escalation in making that initial strike. But on the other hand, having that same capability enables China to have more flexible options to retaliate for an adversary's limited nuclear strikes. And that might also offer China the best, albeit still slim, chance of ending any nuclear exchange initiated by an adversary before it escalates to an all-out nuclear war. Accurate delivery systems that can strike military targets would also make China's nuclear retaliatory operations more compliant with the law of armed conflict, which is a trend among some other nuclear armed powers, and therefore could increase the credibility of those threats. So this is an example of the way in which the same changes to China's nuclear forces can serve both the goal of enhancing the credibility of first-use threats as well as threats of retaliation. And I think the significance of these changes lies in the fact that China has gained some of these capabilities that have applications for first use and also have applications in enhancing the retaliatory nature of its forces, while its prior nuclear force structure was mostly made up of capabilities that were fairly poorly suited towards making threats of first use. That said, I don't think we're seeing a smoking gun signs of a nuclear force posture optimized for coercive first use. So things China has refrained from doing so far, like arming its short-range ballistic missiles or its cruise missiles with nuclear warheads, operational doctrine for first use, the abandonment of its no first use policy, or changes to its command and control arrangements that might enable the faster and easier use of nuclear weapons. So what about a more competitive nuclear strategy, this sort of second possibility of a new goal that China might be adopting? Well, I think it's too early to tell if this is a PRC objective or not from its capabilities alone, because I don't think there's clear evidence yet that China is seeking parity in the size of its nuclear forces, nor is there clear evidence that it's looking for counterforce capabilities of its own or even a nuclear superiority. Why is that the case? Well, because China's nuclear expansion, as much as it might have picked up the pace in the last 4 years, is still starting from a pretty low base, both quantitatively and qualitatively compared to the United States nuclear arsenal, which is what it will be looking to sort of compete with. The size of China's intended arsenal is particularly important as an indicator of that competitive nuclear strategy. Anything, I think, less than parity in China's goals would sort of call into question that motivation. But back in the sort of mid-2010s, China really did have a razor-thin margin for error in its retaliatory forces, a point that was emphasized both in the RAND report, the China Military Scorecard, as well as in academic studies by scholars in both the PRC as well as the United States. And so it would therefore be puzzling from the perspective of some of these nuclear strategists if China didn't seek a larger nuclear arsenal to gain a more comfortable margin for error. And many nuclear strategists, particularly in this country, have been quite puzzled by China's ostensible tolerance for the US having what's called a damage limitation capability vis-a-vis China's arsenal, even if the United States couldn't entirely escape China's nuclear retaliation. And just as a quick aside, a damage limitation capability would enable the US to do better if an all-out nuclear exchange became inevitable, should, for example, it be not credible or not possible for either of the two sides to concede in a nuclear confrontation, but rather concluding that that exchange was inevitable. So I think until China achieves a nuclear force that is big enough to comfortably eliminate that US damage limitation capability, China's growing nuclear arsenal in terms of its size provides just as much evidence of continuity in the goals of its nuclear forces of countering an adversary's efforts at nuclear compellence as a change towards a more competitive nuclear strategy. That said, once China does achieve a force that eliminates the US damage limitation capability, if it then continues to build up its nuclear forces, then we might have more confidence concluding that there was a change in its goals and it was seeking this more competitive type of nuclear strategy. We could also look at other elements of China's nuclear forces for evidence that it's looking at counterforce capabilities. To me, I think the only real capability that China has acquired in the last 4 years, which has a counterforce application but no plausible role in increasing the credibility of China's retaliatory strikes, is the fact that its newest intercontinental range ballistic missile, the DF-41 ICBM, is an accurate ICBM, and it's difficult to sort of see how that would otherwise serve a retaliatory goal. So finally, I think on the question of whether China is seeking a stronger nuclear shield to enable offensive conventional operations, I think this is actually one of the most tricky propositions to test in understanding, you know, how China's nuclear goals might be shifting. And that is because a more robust retaliatory capability, which is a marker of continuity, can then also serve as a stronger nuclear shield for more offensive conventional operations. But let me explain why I'm a little bit skeptical or would like more evidence if China was indeed seeking a larger nuclear force to enable these aggressive conventional operations. And that is because some scholars have shown that at least until around 2019, the planning processes for both conventional and nuclear operations in China were decoupled. So you would see dramatic changes in China's conventional military strategy and no change whatsoever in its nuclear forces. So clearly you were seeing these two processes being sort of separate bureaucratically and not linked up in the PLA's planning processes. What I would want to see if I was thinking of this a stronger nuclear shield argument is driving China's nuclear buildup, that new goal, would be a tighter coupling of those conventional and nuclear planning processes within China. I haven't seen evidence of it yet. That does not mean it's not what's going on, but I would be hesitating until I saw a little bit more evidence thereof. Okay. So in the interest of time, I will just very quickly say a couple of words about my second point, that there's evidence on China's nuclear decision-making processes, that they're shifting. I think I would just note on this point that the fact that China's nuclear decision-making processes are shifting does not necessarily mean that the goals that its force is intended to, its nuclear forces are intended to achieve are also shifting. New decision makers can implement the same goals of countering compellence and retaliating for a nuclear strike in different ways. And they can also pursue a nuclear buildup for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with nuclear strategy and doctrine, that can include things like status as well as bureaucratic interests. And I think Tong has already laid out this, this issue in some detail. And so I will move on to my final point, which is something of a precautionary principle. And that is that I think until we're confident that China's motivations for its nuclear expansion are clearly connected to the strategic goals of its nuclear weapons, the United States should be very careful about acting on the assumption that China's nuclear forces sort of strategy and doctrine have changed in ways that could lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I'll give one quick example. Shedding strategic arms control with Russia in anticipation that China is seeking nuclear parity could actually encourage China to further increase the size of its nuclear arsenal beyond what it may otherwise be planning if its goals were only to eliminate the U.S. damage limitation capability. And I think given the serious consequences of acting on an assumption that China's nuclear forces strategy and doctrine are changing, the evidence of change needs to be stronger than it currently is before the U.S. takes steps that could encourage China to move in a different direction. I'll end, though, just by saying that, of course, China bears some responsibility for this risk as well because of its lack of transparency about what's driving the buildup. And if it hasn't changed its nuclear strategy, then the indiscipline and incoherence that has emerged in its nuclear forces is a contributing factor too. So I'll stop there and look forward to Tong's rebuttal.
Thank you. So it's almost 5:20 right now. So I would ask that Tom and Fiona, if you keep your rebuttal to 5 minutes or less, sure, so that we can leave some time for Q&A. And I apologize to the audience if you need to leave at 5:30. Completely understand, but we might go a little bit over if you want to stay for Q&A. Thank you. But we'll try to keep all the main arguments before 5:30. Thank you. So Tom.
Well, thank you. I think at the strategic level, I fully agree with Fiona. And the main message I think we are both trying to send is the U.S. shouldn't overreact because the Chinese continuity or change in its nuclear strategy may be explained by internal factors that do not necessarily point to a more aggressive nuclear posture. And here I fully agree with Fiona that, I don't think China seeks, well, at least China has not decided to eventually achieve nuclear parity with the United States. I don't think right now China's nuclear strategy is aimed at coercive first use. So we are fully on the same page. And here, what the message, I think I'm trying to emphasize is the changes in the goals and means of Chinese nuclear strategy is more a result of the increasingly chaotic and less organized and incoherent thinking within China. And that's a direct result of China's increasing authoritarian system, where the experts' view are sidelined, where there is no checks and balances, when there is no information about what is really going on about China's nuclear capability. And the Chinese state media, says all the nuclear satellite sites are just windmills. So there is no way to have basic, informed, expert-level discussion and debate about, what goal makes sense for China and what means are effective to achieve those goals. And when you have a, paramount leader, he possesses unquestionable authority and he happens to endorse this view that greater nuclear capability could translate into greater geopolitical benefit. I think that's the root of the problem. And then in this sense, again, this links back to the discussion last session. I think the key problem here is actually increasing authoritarianism. And it has direct and very serious negative consequence on China's capability to make accountable and balanced decision-making, including on nuclear weapons. And if, you know, China can make accountable and balanced decisions, it will be better, that, you know, decision that can better, you know, help, you know, make China, you know, better understand its own interests and have a strategy that can more effectively achieve those interests. China will be better off. The U.S. will be better off. The international community will be better off. The chances of, nuclear arms race will be much lower. But more specifically, let me push back on one point, which is, I don't think evidence supports the assertion that all the nuclear buildup is primarily driven by a desire to maintain credible second strike capability. The view that all of the things, the new things, are simply to increase, you know, to create a comfortable margin for error. I think, you know, that's just, you know, not proportionate to the problem. On the nuclear equation between US and China on the American side, you don't see radical changes of American nuclear capability or nuclear policy. Even on the issue of missile defense, which Chinese experts traditionally believed was the main threat to Chinese nuclear deterrent, there was no radical American change on missile defense policy or capability. So it just cannot explain the radical scale and speed of expansion. And, you know, the near-term focus on the, large scale silo-based ICBM capabilities do not offer the best cost-effective means to address missile defense threat. Again, missile defense was largely agreed by Chinese experts was as the primary threat to China's nuclear deterrent. And the solution China appears to be making does not provide the best way to address that traditional challenge. So I think there is a larger political process that needs to be better understood here. And I do think there is a significant change in the sense that China is closely following American nuclear thinking and is increasingly influenced by American nuclear practices. The decision to pursue China's own nuclear triad capability, the increasing interest in launch and warning capability, all of those resemble American policies. And here I do think there is concrete evidence of China building effective strategic early warning systems, including six large ground-based large phased array early warning satellites and at least three deployed strategic early warning satellites. And there are more down the pipeline. And also the growing interest in escalation control capability. I think all of those are important operational level changes that point to the direction where the military now has more leeway to acquire capabilities that they tend to criticize before. So I think that's the shorter leash that the political leaders are placing on the military explains a lot of the new interest in new capabilities and postures.
Okay, so I will be very brief and just noting a couple of things that Tong's remarks kind of raises points for me. I think one of the really interesting issues that he raised was this increasing sense of existential threat within China, that the rest of that there was going to be more pushback against China's kind of vital interests. And I would just note with that that nuclear weapons are there to counter existential threats, certainly, but not all kinds of existential threats. They are best suited to countering existential threats that come from nuclear weapons or from large-scale conventional attacks. But regime threats, one has to make a couple of kind of logical leaps to think about how nuclear weapons and an increasingly robust nuclear weapons capability is going to secure the regime against whether it is a popular uprising or it is an elite threat to the existing leaders' kind of place in office. There are better tools and there is a well-developed toolkit that the PRC and other authoritarian regimes have developed to keep themselves in power, including in a conflict. And indeed, using nuclear weapons or threatening to use nuclear weapons in that manner could actually end up creating the very regime threat, existential threat in a physical sense that they're attempting to prevent. The second point that I would just make, and this is sort of based on some of my own research looking in the non-nuclear components of China's strategic deterrence capability, is just care in interpreting what a powerful strategic deterrent actually means. Nuclear weapons is definitely a part of that, but it is not the only part of China's strategic deterrent that it is looking to strengthen. There are components that have to do with counter space capabilities, that have to do with precision conventional missiles, as well as other non-nuclear types of capabilities with strategic effect. So there's ambiguity, I think, within that statement. And then the final thing I wanted to just raise is this issue of how PLA authors are writing or are talking about the role of China's nuclear capabilities, this idea of strategic victory that Tong raised. Because I would say I'd seen a couple of sort of comments along those lines as well. And I think the real challenge with us in trying to gain a grasp on what is going on with China's thinking in this space is that we just can't see what's going on in the top leader's mind. Because in the end, those PLA authors or PLA experts who are writing about the way that nuclear weapons may serve China's kind of national interests, they don't have the authority to decide how those weapons will actually be used. They provide options to the leadership, perhaps, but the real challenge we face is trying to understand what it is that's motivating Xi Jinping in building up nuclear capabilities and then trying to anticipate how he might make decisions about how those capabilities are used in any given crisis or conflict.
Great, thank you. I'm going to ask one quick question, and then I will collect questions from the audience since we are still 2 minutes from 5:30. But the one question I had is more of a general question for both Tong and Fiona in terms of how do you study such a difficult topic when we're generally seeing less information from China. And as Tong, you mentioned, what you're perceived to be less checks and balances, less consultation with Chinese nuclear experts. How do you even approach this question and have sort of these debates? And to Fiona, I guess my question for you is why should we have a higher bar for evidence when there's less evidence coming from China? Right? Like, how do you have a higher bar when there's less transparency, more potential political interference? Like, that seems to me we might never reach the bar until China has achieved a certain level of nuclear, has grown its nuclear arsenal to a certain extent. So just wanted some basic information on how you're approaching the problem, given that the issue that we all have now in the United States, it's very difficult to study China, particularly on such a sensitive a military topic.
I can start and be very brief. I think I agree, it's getting much harder than before, but that's why it is increasingly important for the international community to develop both nuclear expertise and regional expertise, especially expertise about China as a country and nation and political system. For one, you need to have very strong connections with people in the system to understand, what role they might have played in decision making or in their consultation with government actors. You can get a little sense of, their view and their role here, and you may get another piece of information there. And collectively, I think that help you build up a more full picture of how the system works. It's important to not only understand China's nuclear thinking, because it's really directly influenced by China's overall security thinking, its overall foreign policy thinking. So we tend also need to follow China's domestic politics, even, internal senior politician, their, internal power structure and their relationship with the defense industry, and how, China's thinking on related but separate areas of foreign policy, security policy looks like. So I think that's just put high demand on the international research community, but I think it can be done.
And so I'll wager a couple of points just to expand on why I'm making the case for a pretty high evidentiary bar. And I think the reason for this is that the costs of getting it wrong are high, and the costs of getting it wrong are high in both directions. Because on the one hand, if China is changing its nuclear strategy in any of these more ambitious ways, failing to sort of anticipate and react to that is going to leave the United States in a very difficult position, because it takes a long time to build up the capacity to do things like build more nuclear weapons, really think about, how the U.S. nuclear forces need to be structured. But on the other hand, reacting as if China is definitely going to go down this pathway also has consequences. My sense is that our current state of public debate is doing a much better job of anticipating the risks of being flat-footed in the response to China's nuclear modernization rather than the risks of overreacting. So I think both of those two sides of the coin need to be given equal consideration. And I think, from the perspective of policymakers, it's easy for an academic to sit there and say, I want more evidence. It's not so easy if you have to actually make decisions that are going to have those kind of long-term consequences. But I would just say to really think through carefully the consequences of any steps that the U.S. and indeed its allies are going to take. And accept that the costs of getting that wrong, and really to be clear about what the costs of getting making decisions on an incorrect assumption or guess about what China is doing is really important. The final thing I'll just add in this area is that often when we talk about nuclear strategy, this is an area that I'm trained in academically, we look at the kind of deductive incentives for the way that states should behave. That's a very powerful tool, but I think it needs to be balanced out by exactly what Tong was just saying, which is looking for evidence that China actually does behave in the way that those deductive models suggest that it should, for two reasons. One is that sometimes other things than those sort of deductive incentives about strategy are what drives decision making, but also because a lot of those deductive models are based on what the US and the Soviet Union did previously and haven't really taken account of the way that other countries might think about their incentives when they look at nuclear strategy.
Let me open it up to questions from the audience, and let me just collect all the questions we have in this room. So I see three over there.
Keep this brief. This is just for Dr. Cunningham. You said that you don't see evidence of a greater coupling within the PLA of kind of the, for lack of a better term, the conventional side and the nuclear side. And you say this is why you don't necessarily see the argument that China might be using nukes as a shield to pursue or enable conventional operations as a sort of argument that's supported by evidence. But you just mentioned the powerful strategic deterrent system. The evidence I've seen in the PLA discussions of that, not that authoritative, right, is, but still in their discussions is, hey, this powerful strategic deterrent system consists of both our nuclear deterrent and our conventional deterrent, defined by what you just mentioned earlier, the precision strike regime, the cyber capabilities, the space capabilities. So given that, what's your interpretation of the powerful strategic deterrent system and whether that could be an indicator that the PLA is using its nuclear buildup as a shield for conventional operations?
I'm wondering if you can comment about any nuclear testing, or are these guys just grinding out 25-year-old designs that were proven way back when? Can you say anything at all about whether these are fission weapons, boosted fission weapons, fusion weapons, plutonium weapons, uranium weapons, tactical weapons, or are they all strategic weapons? Any evidence of neutron bombs?
Thank you. I was curious to connect this to an earlier panel we had on Taiwan, because in a possible Taiwan contingency, and specifically with the U.S. role in such a contingency, no one ever really seems to talk about the nuclear dimension. So I was very curious to your view of what the nuclear aspect would be like in a possible Taiwan contingency. Thank you.
And just for the sake of time, let's get one question from our online audience and get these four questions to our viewers.
Yeah, so we have one question actually from Joseph Rogers here at the CSIS Project on Nuclear Issues. And it's specifically asked of Tong Zhao, what lessons concerning nuclear deterrence have PRC scholars and officers learned from Russia's war in Ukraine? What literature is forming the foundation of PRC strategic understanding of deterrence?
Let me turn it to the two of you. You don't have to answer all four questions, but please pick and choose what you want to answer.
I can go first. I appreciate all the questions. Nuclear testing, I shouldn't spend too much time because, you know, there is a lot of research already. I just say that although China had, only 45 tests, much smaller number than the U.S. and Soviet Union, I think the current research is open source research shows that China nuclear scientists actually mastered very advanced nuclear warhead technology, and they are able to manufacture very miniaturized nuclear warhead with plutonium. They also mastered neutron bomb technology, even though they didn't deploy them. So I'm there is no doubt that if there is political will, China can certainly build more very efficient nuclear warheads that are lightweighted and can be, incorporated into more Mervin capabilities, etc. Taiwan, the nuclear dimension in Taiwan, I think is mostly about providing a shield for conventional operation, even though from China's own perspective, China doesn't see it that way because China has a very, self-righteous way of seeing its conventional operation against Taiwan as fully defensive and within its sovereign right. So it's not an aggression. But, analytically speaking, yes, the main role is to prevent a conventional conflict with the United States from escalating to the nuclear level. The lessons from Ukraine war, one of the most important lessons is that Russia was able to achieve broader security and political goals beyond nuclear deterrence by making implicit threats of nuclear weapons and nuclear use. So in other words, the Chinese allies understood that through tailored and flexible nuclear signaling, right, making implicit reference to nuclear weapons, conducting exercises with nuclear capable weapon systems, conducting tests of nuclear capable delivery systems during a conventional war, could already send an implicit nuclear threat that would influence your adversary's concern about escalation risks, and therefore influence their decisions on conventional level military operation and even political policies and economic sanction policy, etc. So in an unlikely scenario over Taiwan conflict, if China was facing a huge conventional defeat, I think there is chance that China may also try to play this risk of nuclear escalation through implicit nuclear signaling. But I don't think China has put a lot of thought into that scenario because China is it's more confident than before about its conventional capability. And its nuclear policy is not driven significantly by using nuclear weapons first.
So I will be brief in my answers and just connect a little bit this question of, how does China escalate in a Taiwan contingency with this question of the strong strategic deterrent? So to be clear, when I talked about the decoupling of conventional and nuclear, here I'm talking about China's general purpose conventional forces. I'm not talking about the kinds of non-nuclear capabilities that could have strategic effects, because there is a set of capabilities that China has singled out, which include offensive cyber capabilities used against strategic targets, counter-space weapons, and its conventional missile force in particular, that are viewed as having this, as contributing to strategic deterrence alongside nuclear weapons. And so, you know, but on the other hand, offensive cyber operations and counter-space capabilities cannot conduct an island landing campaign. So it's that kind of conventional sort of set of capabilities that I'm talking about when I say that they're decoupled. I see the actually the non-nuclear strategic capabilities as being more tightly coupled with China's nuclear strategy. I've argued in another piece that the way that China essentially thinks about strategic deterrence is a strategic substitution approach, where you are using these kinds of non-nuclear information age capabilities to threaten escalation, including up to the nuclear level, because of the way in which some of these capabilities are entangled with nuclear capabilities, but can also have very provocative effects on an adversary's homeland, military capabilities, et cetera. But together with a nuclear retaliatory capability, then ends up daring your adversary to be the one that crosses the nuclear threshold in retaliation. So those capabilities, I think, is what the PRC is talking about when it talks about a strong strategic deterrence system, is the way in which all of those strategic capabilities, nuclear and non-nuclear, can work together in ways that can provide China with escalatory options that are more credible than needing to reach for its nuclear capabilities the way that the Russians have.
Okay, great. I really appreciate folks staying with us for an extra 12 minutes. And I want to give a round of applause for both of our experts for coming to talk to us and staying beyond the normal business hours. So thank you very much for this very informative discussion.